Last Sunday night, we were in chapter 32, and that's one of the more famous stories of the book of Genesis, the great wrestling match that took place between the Lord and Jacob. And I might at some point here return to some of those ideas, because from the comments from a number of you, it seemed to be that the theme of that particular passage really struck home. And I think all of us are regularly wrestling with this issue of just quiet, restful trust in God to do His work, as opposed to our own manipulating of our circumstances and trying to get the blessing in a pragmatic and fast way. It does seem to be that event marked a major turning point in the life of Jacob. He certainly learned a lesson. Something would stick with him for the rest of his life because of the physical consequence of having to limp along, and always bearing in mind that experience. But I did point out that does not mean that this man never struggled again to do the right thing. And it's like I was saying this morning about the filling of the Spirit. There does need to be a visible display of some measure of the fruit of the Spirit as a part of how God assures us of our salvation. But on the other hand, there is an ongoing, lifelong conflict with the flesh, and the best of us at our best are a mixed bag. And very much the case when you come to the life of Jacob and go out of chapter 32 and read the rest of it. Chapter 33, which we're looking at tonight, the very next event happened very shortly that morning when he was done with the wrestling match, is frankly a difficult passage to figure out when it comes to what in the world Jacob is thinking and doing at this point. In fact, when you compare the commentators, particularly with the first 11 verses, and his meeting with Esau, and some of the things he said, and their interaction there, a wide variety of opinions. And basically, there is a view that is positive about Jacob, and consistently so throughout this passage, saying that Jacob had learned the lesson, that it was fresh on his mind, and that as he did engage in some efforts to ingratiate himself to Esau, we don't want to view this as manipulative, because in fact there are other facts there that indicate he was trusting God for the outcome. We want to view those as Jacob at this point approaching matters wisely and making prudent choices as to how to relate to people who are upset with you, and how to be gracious in trying to be reconciled, and even the point of folks talking about repentance and restitution toward Esau through some of the actions that Jacob is going to take. On the other hand, you have those who say, no, this stuff sounds like the same Jacob we've been reading about all along. And there are questionable things here, as well as matters that are encouraging as he makes certain statements about God, but there's still this approach of looking for what on the human level makes most sense. And if you think about it, in light of particularly the New Testament, here's what would have been an ideal way for chapter 33 to develop. Jacob, very humbly, walks up to Esau and says, Esau, I sinned against you. I'm sorry. God has dealt with me very clearly and very definitely and very painfully the last 20 years. I have learned my lesson. Even though the blessing of the family was coming to me by God's own appointment, I took it in an illegitimate way and I offended you. I cheated you, and that was wrong, and I repent. And will you forgive me, please? I mean, that would have been the most straightforward way to clear up matters. And that's not quite what you read as you come to chapter 33. And so you have people who look at this and come to different conclusions. What I would like us to do is just to go through each interaction that takes place between Jacob and Esau and try to come to some conclusion about that. But I think as we reach the end, particularly of chapter 33, verse 11, we may get our perspective shifted as to really what is most important in this passage and what is being highlighted, whatever we may think about Jacob. This passage does divide up pretty simply into two sections, where in verses 1 to 11, you have the meeting of the two brothers, and they are reconciled to each other. But then, verse 12, all the way to the end of the chapter, they actually walk away from each other. And where you thought they were going to get together and kind of live happily ever after, in fact, you find out that they end up living in totally different places, not apparently having much relationship at all after that. The only other time that anything real specific about Esau's mention is when they get together to bury Isaac a little bit later. But evidently these men living apart from each other, maybe that was the wisest thing given all of the factors. But when we speak of them being reconciled, between how things develop at the end of the chapter and your questions about the way that Jacob approaches it, I'm entitling this tonight a questionable reconciliation. In other words, there are some ambiguities here. We don't know totally what to make of some of this. That's not too unusual when you're reading a story. A narrative will often bring things up that are not going to the main point of the story, that may leave some questions in your mind that are just designed to tell you what happened, that are just designed to pique your curiosity and keep you reading. We have a lot of questions. There are some factors here that I don't think it's necessarily the point of the passage to deal with, but I'd like us to get at the essence of what the Lord intends here. So, looking first of all at verses 1 to 11, however you are going to view this, it was a kind of reconciliation. That's when there is finally, after 20 years of being separated geographically and being separated emotionally, these men have their relationship restored. What goes on over 20 years? Have you ever been in a situation where you've had a falling out with somebody and it took you this long to get things worked out? That's a long time to be at odds, not just with some guy on the street, but your very own brother. You want to put yourself in that event, in that experience. Maybe it'll help us feel the tension, the fear, to feel the depth of the emotion that's going to come out here in just a little bit. So let's work together here, first of all, in verses 1 to 11. And that breaks down, first of all, in verses 1 to 3, Jacob prepares for the encounter. It says in verse 1, "Behold, Esau was coming, and 400 men with him." And as far as Jacob knew, those were men coming to attack him. He had no reason to think otherwise, then there was a hostile purpose there. And we read about that in chapter 32, his fear and the steps he took and now carried out here in verse 1. He divided the children among Leah and Rachel and the two female servants. And he put the servants with their children in front, then Leah with her children, and Rachel and Joseph last of all. He himself went on before them, bowing himself to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother. What do you make of that? Well, as we go through here and we look at these different actions and these different words that are said, we're going to try to evaluate. Is this something positive? In other words, is this a good thing, what's happening? Is this something negative, where on the basis of Scripture or something that's clearly said, we say, now that was a bad move, that was wrong, or that wasn't best? Or is it one of these things that we're not totally sure about? Is it questionable? Is it a bit dubious, but it's a little hard to be dogmatic and just come down really strong on Jacob? Those are our categories, right? It's like when somebody asks you a question and the options are yes, no, or maybe. That's what we're doing here for each of these actions. Is this positive? Is it negative? Is it questionable at best? So, what do you make of the first step he takes of dividing the children? I would say, at best, that's questionable. It's questionable because, as we had read in the other chapter, that was his effort really to protect himself, and he was willing to risk the life of maybe some of his family if in fact there was an attack going to happen. He's willing to put some of them forward to be dealt with first. Not really sure what to make of that, why he's doing that at this point after the Lord had dealt with him and deepened his faith. But then especially when you read on the way that he divided them. What if you had been one of these sort of secondary wives, or what if you had been Leah and everybody else is put up in front? And back over here in the most protected spot, right back there, you have Rachel and Joseph. I mean, Joseph is mentioned by name. None of the others are mentioned here. He's the one who gets the special protection. And this problem of favoritism, which is not the first time it's come up in Genesis, it's not going to be the last time it's going to come up in Genesis, is going to create a lot of problems as you read on about the family of Jacob. So we would say, whatever else is going on, that does not sound like a good thing. That's a negative issue. And then what about verse 3? I think there's something a little positive. Because whatever he may have been thinking originally, we were probably not expecting this, that verse 3, he himself, that is Jacob, went on before them. Maybe out of guilt, maybe as a last minute change of heart, he decides to take responsibility, to take some leadership. This morning we were speaking about that with the men, and instead of putting his family forward to kind of take the blow for him, he says, all right, forget about it. This is my responsibility. I'm going to step forward. I'm going to put my neck on the line. I am going to be the one to initiate this reconciliation. But then what about the rest of it? Bowing himself to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother. Now, repentance and humility would be a good thing. But given everything you know and some of the wording that's going to come up here, I'm not really sure what to do with that myself. Sevenfold obeisance. I mean, this is just over the top groveling, really. I mean, it's the kind of thing that an abject slave would do if he were approaching somebody high and mighty in power. But this is his brother. And is this feigned humility? Is this just an effort to get in good with him, to impress him? What's going on? I'm not really sure what to make of that. And then they finally meet. And so in verses 4 to 7, we're going to find out about their first interaction. All these little snippets of conversation that took place that you have recorded here. Verse 4. This is a surprise. I mean, this is just downright incredible. Everything else you know would not have led you to this. Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. Of course, this is a much later passage, but in what other place to read something pretty much like that? There are those who say that when Jesus was telling the story of the prodigal son, he lifted that statement, that sentence, right from Genesis 33, as a way of picturing a beautiful, tender reconciliation. We expect that in the prodigal son. Of course, the father pictures God. But good night, this is Esau. This is Esau at this point, who is running to meet his twisted, conniving brother, and embraces him and falls on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. I would say that's a pretty good thing. I would call that positive, Esau's affectionate embrace. And some of the points that come up here, in many ways, Esau ends up looking better than Jacob. Now that's a turning of the tables. In other words, there have been a lot of things going on in his heart over the last 20 years, too. Now, we don't know In fact, I seriously doubt that this man was a believer, based on everything else we read about him in Scripture. But at least as far as the family side of things, and the real conflict between these two brothers, I mean, the last thing we heard from Esau was, I'm going to kill him. I'm going to kill him. And now he is running and embracing him, and they are weeping. Just astounding. Well, they're going to talk. When Esau lifted up his eyes and saw the women and children, he said, "Who are these with you?" Jacob said, "The children whom God has graciously given your servant." And I would say that as Jacob describes the people and the things that he has with him, we have seen these kind of comments building up all throughout his life, that more and more he's recognizing whatever I may have done or tried to do to get the blessing, ultimately this goes back to God. The Lord is the one who, and listen to how he says it, has graciously given these children to me. That's encouraging. That's a right perspective. That's a positive development. But in the same breath, he uses a term that last time he had used in chapter 32 that we were critical of. Again, given what God had said, that the elder was going to serve the younger, why is Jacob describing himself as Esau's servant? I don't know that that is a good thing. It seems to me that there is this groveling going on again, and really an unnecessary kind of humiliation to the point where it's going against what the Lord actually intended. That's questionable. Well, the wives and the children had apparently been instructed very well, and they engaged in the same questionable behavior that Jacob had engaged in when this started. The servants drew near, they and their children, and they bowed down. Leah likewise, and her children drew near and bowed down. And last, Joseph and Rachel drew near, and they bowed down. So it seems to be that they had been well prepped to know how to react and how to respond to Esau. And I'm not so sure that this kind of obeisance is a good thing. It's really hard to be dogmatic about some of these details, but at least it raises questions in your mind. If the story had stopped there, we really would be at a loss to know what to do. But there is another interaction, and actually several more. So let's go on to the second bit of conversation that takes place in the one verse, verse 8. Esau said, "What do you mean by all this company that I met?" And what is he talking about? He's talking about all those droves of animals. What was it, 550 different animals that he had selected as a present to ingratiate himself to Esau? Chapter 32 described them in very specific categories. And Jacob says, "To find favor in the sight of my Lord." I think that also is questionable. He's saying, "I'm trying to use this stuff to find favor before you." And again, he puts himself as the servant of his brother, and he actually calls him my Lord. That really does not seem to be fitting with the covenant. Well, there's going to be a third interaction going on to verse 9. And this will bring us to the basic end of the reconciliation itself. Verse 9. "But Esau said, 'I have enough, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself.'" Now that's incredible. Given that this man had been so hungry for the blessing, so hungry for material prosperity, so broken and bitter when his brother had stolen the birthright and then the blessing, I think that's a positive development that Esau says, "Hey, it's okay. Don't worry about it." That's a very humbling thing for Jacob to hear. I mean, when you have had a strained relationship and you go and confess or make some effort and the person says, "Don't worry about it, it's fine." I mean, you're thrilled. And this would have been a great opportunity to just bring it all to a close and everybody goes on. Jacob is not quite done at this point. But I would say that Esau's rejection of the gift is a positive development. Now, one thing I do want to point out, all through these comments from Esau, though they are good things he's saying, not once does he ever mention God. So that would suggest that the change in his heart is basically horizontal. He is not himself deliberately tying God into the picture. We know that God behind the scenes has been working. That all blessing, all grace, all provision goes back to God, including the change that has taken place in his heart for Esau. But Esau doesn't see that dimension of it. He's looking at it from the earthly and family standpoint. Now listen to what Jacob is going to say. No, verse 10, please, if I have found favor in your sight, then accept my present from my hand. For I have seen your face, which is like seeing the face of God, and you have accepted me. I think it's questionable that he insists. Now, you've got to take it. You know how awkward it is when somebody wants to give you something that you really don't want. They want to pay for your meal or something. You kind of debate who's going to pay. And it's a bit tense there. Well, Jacob puts his foot down. He says, no, you need to take this. If I really have found favor, then prove it to me by taking this. As if to sort of cushion himself, and maybe as a protective measure for anything that may come up in the future, I have provided this for him. I have repaid him through all of these things for whatever grief I have caused him. Maybe what he's thinking at that point. But then the next statement, this is fascinating. For I have seen your face, which is like seeing the face of God. When have you seen that expression before? Wasn't that what he called the place where he had wrestled with the angel? He says, I call this Peniel, which means the face of God, because I've seen the face of God here. Esau doesn't know that background, but that's just where he had walked away from. That's what's on his mind. That is the background. And I would take that as a positive statement, that he sees the favorable face of Esau toward him as a reflection of God's favorable face toward him and the blessing that he was promised over there at the river. It's kind of a strange twist of events that he's looking at Esau and he says, seeing your face is like seeing the face of God. That's not literally true. And in fact, there are plenty of things about Esau's character that would want us to disconnect him from God. But we understand what Jacob is saying. I mean, this seems to be a recognition on his part that God has worked on his behalf, and the happy face of Esau toward him is an indication of the Lord's favor. He's acknowledging that. But verse 11, it goes the other way, or at least raises questions. Please accept my blessing that is brought to you. Now, earlier he had described it as a present or as a gift, but now he describes all those animals as my blessing. And that's the same word blessing that had come up way back when Isaac had pronounced that Jacob was going to be the one who's going to continue the covenant, who's going to get God's blessing, the family blessing. And now he's saying, no, it's almost as though by giving you these things, I am returning the blessing, or at least a portion of it, to you. Not really sure what to make of that. Accept my blessing. That raises some questions. But then, in the next breath, that's good, because God has dealt graciously with me, and because I have enough. And if you think back to the covenant had said, those who bless you will be blessed. So maybe that's what Jacob is thinking. I'm not sure, but he does confess that the Lord is the one who has given him all of these things. And he does put his foot down. He urged him, and finally Esau took it. And that's the end of the reconciliation itself. Kind of an odd way to patch up problems with your brother that you offended. And if I had been Esau, I would have been wondering, I think, what is this guy up to this time? But it's not entirely clear, and I want us to come to this conclusion as we move on to the next section here. What are we going to conclude thematically? Whatever questions we may have about Jacob, what is the point of all of this? What would God have us take away from it as the main theological truth? And I'm trying to be consistent with what I try to tell my students, and that is, if the Bible is not clear on something, don't get up and be dogmatic. So that's what we're going to say about this situation. I would tend to take the more negative side of Jacob at this point. I do think that while Jacob's dealings with Esau, they do seem to be a bit manipulative. On the other hand, it is hard to be sure about the nature of some of his actions. There are some ambiguities here, and I don't think we necessarily need to know the final answer about every last one of those statements in order to appreciate the overall teaching of this passage. While Jacob's dealings with Esau seem to be a bit manipulative, it is hard to be sure about the nature of some of his actions. However, as I've been suggesting, I don't think that's the main point of all this. There are plenty of other places we could go to, both before and after this passage, where the focus is on Jacob, and there's a real window into what is actually happening there, and what God is doing in his life, and how these events are working on him. We don't really need this passage for that purpose. I think the focus here is on something else. It seems to me that the focus is not primarily on Jacob, but on Esau. That instead of wondering what's going on with Jacob here, we ought to just be stunned that his brother is accepting him so graciously, and that basically Jacob didn't have to do any of this, because before a word was out of his mouth, Jacob is standing there bowing down 7 times, and before anything else happens, his brother runs to him and embraces him. In other words, none of that other stuff was really necessary. This man's heart was turned toward his brother. I think what is truly amazing in all of this is that apart from all of Jacob's efforts, whatever we might make of that, God, through those years, has changed Esau's heart toward Jacob. Do you believe God can do that? There is something we call common grace, and there are many manifestations of it. Jesus taught that God the Father causes rain to shine on the wicked as well as the righteous. And that unsaved people, although in the ultimate sense of honoring God, they're unable to please God. But nevertheless, they do things on the earthly human level that are good. And all you have to do is look around. I mean, I'm not aware that it was necessarily a Christian who built this building, who put together the clothes on your back, who came up with ideas like lighting a whole room like this artificially, plumbing and running water, automobiles. You benefit all the time from the products of common grace, God blessing you through people who are, and in many cases will for all eternity be under his judgment. And God is able to do good things even in the hearts of unsaved people, and as we think specifically about what's happening in this passage, of actually turning their hearts toward you and working out reconciliation to some degree. It's just remarkable what's taking place here. Now, this isn't the end of the story, and I believe as you read on to chapter 33, verse 12, the focus is shifting away from Esau now to Jacob, because Esau is going to travel back home, and he's going to just kind of go off the stage at that point, and now we really are reading about what's happening in Jacob's heart. And one of the reasons why I would tend to be a little negative about Jacob in verses 1 to 11 is that when you go to verses 12 to 20, there are some definitely negative things going on as far as where to from here with Jacob. The brothers reconcile in verses 1 to 11. The brothers separate in 12 to 20. And here again, as they continue talking, and as Jacob does certain things, we want to ask the question, is this positive? Is this negative? Is this questionable? And beginning with the fourth time that they speak to each other in verses 12 to 14. Then Esau said, "Let us journey on our way, and I will go ahead of you." I mean, that, you just continue to be amazed. You might have expected Esau to say, "Okay, whatever, time wounds all heals. Heals all wounds. Time heals all wounds. Let's leave it in the past. Whatever. I've got what I need. Who cares? See ya." I mean, he's saying, let's go down here, let's live together. That's basically what he's saying. "Let us journey on our way, and I will go ahead of you." He's inviting him home. That becomes apparent later on in verse 14 when Jacob specifically mentions Seir, which is a city, a location in Edom, which is the area that Esau's people populated. I mean, it's not like, you know, shake hands, agree to disagree, and, you know, let's just go our separate ways because that's going to be best for everybody. He's inviting him home. It's going to be okay. I'd say that's a positive thing. Esau's desire to travel with Jacob and even anticipating that they would live close by somehow. Well, what is Jacob going to say? He keeps talking in these terms, "My Lord." He says that in verse 13, he says it in verse 14 at the beginning, and in verse 14 at the end. So three more times he's using that kind of questionable language. And what do you make of this? "The children are frail, the nursing flocks and herds are here to me. If they are driven hard for one day, all the flocks will die. Let my Lord pass on ahead of his servant, and I will lead on slowly at the pace of the livestock that are ahead of me and at the pace of the children until I come to my Lord in Seir." You say, well, he's got a point. I mean, Edom's about 100 miles away, and Esau's got these 400 men that are used to traveling pretty quickly and making a lot of progress, but he's got this huge entourage of animals, and including a bunch of little kids. You can't drive them too hard. In fact, if you drive the animals too hard, they're going to die. Well, there's probably some truth to that. But if there's any question as to what he's thinking, all I got to do is read on to the next section. And you find out that this really was a questionable refusal. Because he gives him the impression, "I'm going down there to be with you. It's just going to take me a lot longer because of all these people and animals that I have with me." Knowing what you know about Jacob, that kind of sounds like an excuse. It kind of sounds like his way of sort of getting out from under the pressure and going to do something else, because in fact he does go do something else. Edom is about 100 miles from this point. What does he end up doing? Well, verses 15 to 17 are going to get us to that. But first of all, once again, Esau comes off looking pretty kind. He says, "Let me leave with you some of the people who are with me." Seems to be he's offering some help of these men to go along with Jacob and help them out, to guide them and protect them all the way down there. And Jacob, "What need is there? Let me find favor in the sight of my Lord." So he says, "My Lord," again, same kind of language he's used a number of times. And that doesn't set well. That refusal is questionable at best. And then what's going to happen? They've had this fourth little conversation. And what you read in verses 16 to 17, "Esau returned that day on his way to Seir. But Jacob journeyed to Succoth and built himself a house and made booths for his livestock. Therefore, the name of the place is called Succoth." And Succoth is not in the same direction as Edom. Edom is over on the east side of Palestine, the Jordan River, and it's way down there. Succoth is going west toward Palestine. Okay? So he goes in a different direction, and Succoth is apparently just a few miles west of where they are at this point. And it's not like he's just sort of spending the night, because it says he built himself a house and made booths for his livestock. And this settlement of his, in his mind, is for this time so much his home that eventually the name of the place takes on the name of booths. In fact, it's interesting, you know, the Jews later would celebrate the feast of booths or tabernacles. This is the word. In Hebrew, it's the Sukkoth, because of those shelter type structures that the people of Israel were remembering, the places that they lived during the wilderness wanderings. But originally that name was referring to the tabernacles, or the structures, the kind of hut that Jacob made for his animals. And as far as himself is concerned, he built himself a house in that place. In other words, he apparently had no intention of going down to Edom. So his settling there, instead of going to Seir, seems to me to be a very negative development. And you just have a few verses left. They really are a transitional passage into chapter 34. If you know what chapter 34 is about, maybe some real red flags are starting to wave in your mind. What are we going to make of these final verses, 18 to 20, the conclusion and the transition to that other story? We really never do find out whatever happened to Jacob and Esau, whether he ever went down there, whether it was ever a factor. It seems to be he just stayed permanently up northerly. And in fact, verses 18 to 20 are going to tell you that he moved somewhere else. Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, on his way from Paddan Aram, and he camped before the city. So now what has he done? Succoth is over on the east side of the Jordan. He's crossing the Jordan into Palestine itself. In fact, it sort of draws your attention to that. I mean, you already knew this if you knew the map, but it says Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan. Now, that has positive associations because God promised the land to them. You know that eventually they're supposed to live there. But again, if you're thinking about chapter 34 and what people are like in Canaan, this is not really a good thing. There's a kind of a foreboding to this. What is he doing? Particularly when instead of kind of finding his own encampment out there in the middle of nowhere, setting up his own city, he camps before the city of Shechem. Does that ring a bell? Remind you of anything else that went on in the book of Genesis? That is precisely what happened in the life of Lot when he drew closer and closer to the city of Sodom. And this is a negative development. Jacob's move to Shechem. And here is an important point that comes up to really help you understand the Lord's perspective. Go with me back to chapter 28 when Jacob was on his way out of the land. And he has that dream at Bethel. And he recognizes that this is the house of God. In verse 20, Jacob made a vow saying, "If God will be with me, and will keep me in this way that I go, and will give me bread to eat and clothing to wear, so that I come again to my father's house in peace." Had God done that? God had done so much more than just give him food and clothes. He had brought him back just overloaded with possessions. But he said, "If God will do those things for me, then the Lord shall be my God. And this stone which I have set up for a pillar shall be God's house. And of all that you give me, I will give a full tenth to you." And what he's vowing there is if God protects him, provides for him, brings him back safely, works everything out with his family, Then Jacob is saying, I'm going to come back to this place and I'm going to build a site of worship for God here. Bethel was the destination that he should have been moving toward. But he takes a pretty slow route. And first of all, he builds a house in Succoth. And then he moves to Shechem, right in front of a pagan Canaanite city. And furthermore, it says in verse 19, from the son of Hamor, Shechem's father, he bought for 100 pieces of money the piece of land on which he had pitched his tent. Now, what do you make of that? I think there's a mixed nature to that. Just like when Abraham bought a piece of property to bury his family, it became a kind of a token that they were going to possess the promised land, so that in some ways any piece of land that these people obtain from the Canaanites ends up being a foretaste of the fulfillment of the whole promise that the land is going to be theirs. But you're still asking yourself, where is this going? Why in front of this city? This is a mixed blessing. This isn't where he's supposed to be. And then you have the same kind of sense about verse 20. There he erected an altar and called it El Elohe Israel. Now obviously anytime somebody builds an altar and is worshiping the one true God, particularly in the book of Genesis, because this is what Abraham regularly did. You're saying, well, here's a sign of faith. Here's a sign of devotion. Here's a step of progress in his life. And as far as that goes, this was a good thing. But again, I'm saying this is mixed, because his promise was, I'm going to build this shrine to God at Bethel, which is further south in the promised land. And he was detained here. He called this altar El Elohe Israel, which you could do the grammar in different ways there. God, the God of Israel. So in other words, he's looking at God, particularly in God's omnipotence and God as creator, and saying that God, the great and mighty, majestic, transcendent God, is my God. And I have seen him work on my behalf. That is a statement of faith. And it is encouraging that he is thinking this way and recognizing the Lord. But given what you know of the background, you're still wondering, is this really the place where he ought to be? Particularly when you do the chronology here. We don't know about some of the time frame, but he would have been in that area about 10 years before finally he makes his way to Bethel and fulfills his vow. There was no reason to wait that long, because God had amply provided for him. And so what are we going to make of this as we think about Jacob wrapping up this second section? Here's what I would say. This section of the narrative, unlike the first 11 verses, presents a more clearly negative picture of Jacob. Specifically, that despite so many evidences of God's favor, his commitment to the Lord at this point is still half-hearted. And when you read, as he finally went to Bethel, there really is a sense of definitiveness about this. There's a sense of, I'm finally doing what I told God I would do. There is a full enjoyment of fellowship with God and the blessing of God. And yet that is preceded by about 10 years of what we would have to call a half-hearted recognition of the Lord and obedience to Him. And if you think that's a little harsh, it's at that point I would point us to what we'll look at another time, and that is what in the world is going to happen in chapter 34. I think as you look at those very gruesome events, we need to understand that as God working through the bad choices of this man, putting his children in the environment of this very wicked place, And yes, the wicked were judged through them. But there are some very painful things that this family went through that they did not have to go through. And I believe it was because Jacob settled down in the wrong place. And he did not follow through fully in his commitment to the Lord. And it's a sobering thing. In fact, let me end with this quotation. The author says, whatever his motivation, Jacob's compromise and his failure to follow through with complete obedience to what he had vowed would cost him and his family dearly, as we shall see in the following chapter. Almost obedience is never enough. Being in the right ballpark may be sufficient when watching a baseball game, but it is not nearly enough when it comes to obeying God. Nothing short of full obedience is required. We all know that intellectually. So why is it then that we are so like Jacob, inclined to settle for a halfway house instead of going all the way home to God? Why is it that so often we need a crisis in our lives to move us that short step from almost obedience, namely Shechem, to full unreserved obedience, namely Bethel? And yet this is a pretty accurate picture, I think, of our human nature. The Lord has put these things in here to warn us, to instruct us. It doesn't have to be this painful. Now, as I've thought about these series of messages, the series of messages from Genesis, and especially last week, I really have not taken a lot of time for very specific application. Really, my focus has been using these as kind of teaching tools for how to study and how to get principles of doctrine and truths about God, truths about the gospel, truths about our lives from these Old Testament stories. We haven't been very specific in our application. But I think that may be appropriate. Maybe we'll come back to some of these things and ask some more specific questions. But you think about this point, and the applications could be multiplied a hundredfold, I'm sure. Application will be different for everybody in this room. Because whatever I struggle to obey the Lord fully in, it's probably going to be a little different from whatever you struggle with. And there may be areas of faith or obedience or commitment or half-heartedness that you're thinking of right now that would not cross the other person's mind. And I trust the Lord will enable us to think this out. Think out the rest of the study for ourselves. What would this mean for me? Am I only giving the Lord a half-hearted kind of loyalty and obedience? Is there some specific area of life that He is calling for a deeper and more complete and more earnest obedience about?